Hey guys, welcome to episode 2 of the Where Do I Begin podcast. I am your host, Lola. Hope you've all had a chance to listen to episode 1. It really does set the foundation for today's episode. I have also got some market news and some potential stocks that I may mention at some point. So do make sure you have a listen all the way through because I'm not entirely sure when I might drop them. We'll see how the episode goes. But before I go any further, you all know the drill. We have a lot to get to. But first, I have to read out this disclaimer. So here we go. All information presented or spoken about on this podcast is for educational and general information use only. This is not investment or financial advice. Therefore, any information discussed should not be interpreted as personalized investment advice. Before making an investment decision, please do your own research, verify information for accuracy, and speak to a financial advisor. Please be aware that liability for any investment decisions made falls entirely on you. Any brands, companies, or investment platforms referenced during the duration of this podcast and future episodes are for educational purposes. This podcast is not sponsored by any of the brands or companies mentioned. Any information or advice given by guests solely represents the opinion of the guests and is independent of the Where Do I Begin podcast. So now for today's episode, we're going to be talking about the stock market, as you can probably tell from the title, because that's where the money resides. Okay, the stock market is really a hot topic. That tends to get everyone in their feelings, so I'll try not to be in my feelings for this one. To start with, though, I do want to read out this quote by Warren Buffett. If you're not willing to own a stock for 10 years, don't even think about owning it for 10 minutes. Now, if you're not familiar with who Warren Buffett is, some call him one of the godfathers or founding fathers when it comes to investing. But essentially, he's an American investor, a business tycoon, he's a philanthropist, and he's one of the most successful investors in the world. I currently have net worth of $85.6 billion, making him the world's fourth wealthiest person. So if he says that you should be owning a stock for roughly 10 years or more, then I think it's only wise to listen to that. Now, why is it important to hold a stock for 10 minutes versus hold a stock for 10 years, or hold a stock for 10 years versus hold a stock for 10 minutes? There are many reasons why he would make a statement like this. And the reason being is when we're talking about generational wealth and you're trying to grow your money or invest to grow your money, for it to get to the brackets, which would be considered generational wealth, and you know, you want to leave a legacy for your family, you cannot achieve that by buying and selling stocks every day. That's not quite how it works. Now, for I guess my colleagues that are into trading, that are trading every day, buying and selling, I'm sure they don't necessarily fully subscribe to this statement by Warren Buffett because their goals are obviously different. So for those who are into trading, you might find that they hold stocks for much shorter periods of time, i.e. a 6-week period, for example, or an 8-week period or a 10-week period. And it's not to say that those investments are not profitable just because they're held for a shorter term period. It just means when we're talking about generational wealth, constant movement of your money does not, you are able to make some profitable returns, but that constant movement does not get you to that generational wealth bracket, essentially. Obviously, depending on your investment goals, that would also play a part as to how long you should, I guess, leave your money in a particular stock. So last week we spoke about short-term or medium-term investments and long-term investments. So let's say you wanted to invest for, I don't know, to be able to get a mortgage, for example, or for a wedding, that will come on the short to medium term. So you're looking at potentially investing 3 to 5 years ahead of the time where you're looking to probably achieve that specific goal. Whereas if you're talking about, investing for a pension, you're looking at 10-year plus or more. And the reason why it's important for you to have some investments that you don't touch and you hold for 10 years plus or more is so that you can give those investments to recuperate when there are changes in the economy. As we all know, the economy is a very dynamic environment that is fast paced, and essentially anything can happen. So if you're constantly making decisions on the go about a particular stock, based off of what's going on in the economy or what's even going on in the markets, for example, you don't necessarily have all the available information out there as to why you should buy this particular, stock, or why you should sell this particular stock in that immediate moment. As they always say, hindsight is 20/20. Whereas if you're holding a stock for a rough period of 5 years, if something happened in the economy, i.e. there was a period of high inflation, for example, you've given your investment time to sort of recuperate and recover and adjust to account for the impact of inflation. For those who are not aware, inflation is basically a rise in the general prices of things. So it could be food, commodities, whatever. But that also actually affects the return on your investments. Okay. There's research that shows that the Standard & Poor's S&P 500 index has actually experienced losses in only 10 out of the 45 years it's been in existence. So we're talking from 1975 to 2019, which basically shows that stock market returns are quite volatile in the short run. However, investors have historically experienced a much higher rate of success over the long term. So again, when we're talking about, achieving returns that are significant, returns that could potentially help you build, generational wealth and leave a legacy, then you need to be looking at having some investments that you can hold for 10 years or more. That's not to say you can't hold investments that are only for a shorter period of time, but they cannot make up the majority of your portfolio, basically, if that makes sense. So another reason why I guess it's important to, when you're investing, to have a longer term outlook is due to something called the random walk theory. Now, the random walk theory is basically a theory that basically states that the price of securities, i.e. stocks, moves randomly in the short term, particularly. And as a result, any attempt to predict future stock price movement, either through fundamental or technical analysis, is futile. So it's basically useless. And they believe this is based on two assumptions. Like I mentioned earlier, that the stock price tends to follow a random walk, so it's random. As you can tell from the name. And then the second assumption is that the price of one security is always independent of the movement and the price of another security. So what that means is, let's say you take Tesla stock and Apple stock. Just because Tesla stock fell today doesn't mean Apple stock is necessarily also going to fall. So it's saying that the movement in the stock price is not dependent on what the other stock is doing. Now, as with every theory that has been tried and tested, there will always be another school of thought. So there are obviously critics that, argue the opposite of this, and they believe that the random walk theory is flawed, and they particularly believe that stock prices do follow patterns or trends over the long term. The reason they argue this is because they believe that the stock price is affected by a varied number of different factors, which I'm going to explain in a bit, and that just because it's not possible to necessarily discern, what's causing the movement in prices in the short term, it doesn't mean that a pattern doesn't exist. As I mentioned earlier, hindsight is 20/20. So where do I stand on this? I absolutely am a believer in the random walk theory. But I also believe that in the long term, you can explain why prices, you know, were at a particular point on a particular day, at a particular time, once you've taken in all the factors that could potentially influence the stock price. You know, every day, whenever the stock market goes up or down, you have people, you know, trying to explain, sometimes speculating as to why the price is up today or the price is down today. Now, some of those reasons are usually just pure speculation, whereas some of those are based on some facts. And it's important to sort of understand how the market works in this way, so that you're able to make a well-informed decision. You know, when you're making a decision to either buy a particular stock or sell a particular stock, you know, you always find people who sometimes try to time the market perfectly, or they make decision based on, you know, their emotions. You know, let's say the price of a particular stock that was a favorite of theirs crashed. Now they feel all of a sudden they need to sell it. And that's not always the wisest move, because there's more that needs to be considered, that needs to be analyzed before you make that decision. You cannot afford to invest emotionally. That's the quickest way to basically lose money or lose some of the returns that, you know, you've gained, which is why I said in last week's episode that, you know, you need to look deeper into a company's financials. When you're looking a bit deeper than the stock price and you're looking into their financials, i.e. what their core services are, how the stock price sort of reflects on the earnings, you know, are they aligned, you know, what's their stance on, I don't know, environmental and social governance, for example, what's going on in the economy and what impacts does it have on the company, you know. Things like that come under fundamental analysis. Technical analysts, on the other hand, they sort of look at the historical stock price for particular stocks. They look at the trends, and then they analyze that and try to use that to predict the growth and the future movement of a particular stock price. Now, I've seen memes on social media that sort of point to the fact that, you know, fundamentalists and technical analysts are always at odds, but I personally believe that there is a space for both in order to be able to make a well-informed decision about a particular stock. In a future episode, I will have someone who is a technical analyst on, and they would just give you their perspective on, I guess, how to sort of make sense of the market using technical analysis. Now, given my economics background, one of the first things you will learn in economics is the law of supply and demand. And it's quite funny, because when people are thinking about the stock market, sometimes that's the furthest thing from their mind. And it's like the law of supply and demand, actually is very much applicable to the stock market as well. So the law of supply and demand basically states that if demand increases, the price of the particular item also goes up. And if supply increases, the price of the particular item goes down, because, you know, there's more of it available. So it's not a fight because there's scarcity. Does that make sense? So the same thing, the same principle pretty much works when it comes to the stock market. The stock market, or the marketplace where stocks are sold, determines what the price, you know, should be for each stock to some extent. When you think about stocks and shares, when demand for shares essentially exceeds supply, it means that there are more buyers than sellers in the market, and as a result, the price of that stock or share increases. Whereas when demand is less than supply, meaning that buyers are less than sellers in the market, then the price increases. So that's how you can see it working in the stock market. Another factor that affects the stock price is interest rates. Now, at the moment, we all know that interest rates are currently quite low. And what happens when there are low interest rates is that the cost of borrowing goes down. People tend to have more disposable income. Demand for funds tends to go higher. And as a result, demand for stocks and shares goes up. You may have noticed on social media, especially when the pandemic first started and stock prices were falling, people were saying, you know, now is the time to buy, now is the time to buy. part of the reason for that was because there was low interest rates, and so share prices and stock prices dropped, so it was obviously cheaper, you know, to buy in, and people had more disposable income and so on and so forth. The reverse is also applicable, so the reverse is also true. So when there's high interest rates, that reduces demand, you know, for funds, and the demand for shares is lower, and so you have, I guess, more shares available to buy, so which is an increase in supply, and then as a result the stock price is also lower. Another factor that could affect the stock price is something called dividends. So dividends are basically the profits that a company makes that is then distributed to shareholders as a result of the investment in the company. So basically like your return on your investment. So that would be a stock that pays dividends would be known as an income paying stock, because you have other stocks like, let's say, Apple stock, for example, which is a high growth company who doesn't pay dividends. Now, when it comes to dividends, some companies pay quarterly, but most tend to do it annually. So it just depends on the company and the structure they have in place. So why is this a factor that can affect the stock price? Dividends can indicate the movement in the stock or share price. So what happens is usually when companies, you know, make a public announcement or a dividend announcement that they'll be paying dividends, you know, let's say December 2020 or December 2021, it's an indication usually to shareholders that the company is currently doing well and that they have a positive expectation for future growth. So when they make that kind of dividend, it basically, that's what it signals. It's like a price signaling sort of system to shareholders and those that may have been sort of looking at the stock and they're not currently shareholders. It sort of signals to them that this might be a company you might want to buy into, because, you know, they're essentially, you know, giving the shareholders, you know, a healthy return on their investments. They don't have any issues, you know, paying the dividend. So usually what happens is once that announcement is made, the price of the stock tends to go up, because you now have people on the outside as well who are now interested in buying the stock, because to them, it's a signal that this particular company or this particular stock is doing well and is likely to continue to grow in the future. The reverse is also true. If the dividend rate that is announced is lower, or the company makes an announcement that unfortunately they're not able to pay dividends this year for whatever reason, you know, investors' expectations tends to be very bleak, and as a result the share price or the stock price of that particular stock is likely to fall. And as I mentioned earlier, because it's a price signal, those that were on the outside that were sort of, you know, looking at this particular stock, they're unlikely to buy in, because it's a signal to them that, okay, maybe this company is in trouble. Now, there has been times in the past where companies have made dividend announcements, but they were actually in financial trouble, but they did that to sort of manipulate the market and make people on the outside that were not currently shareholders think that the company was doing well and that they expected, you know, high growth in the future. And it's worked for some and it's backfired on some. I don't actually think that is legal for them to do, but people have done it in the past. I can't remember the name of the company that did it a few years back. But if I remember, I may post it on Instagram. And that's why, again, you have to look beyond the surface, because sometimes people would use something that's meant to be, I guess, one of the reliable metrics to measure if this is an investment that you should make. Sometimes people may try to, you know, manipulate it. And if a company that's in financial trouble makes that sort of announcement, you know, it sort of manipulates people into buying in. And if they're not able to recover, because let's say there weren't enough people that, you know, bought in as a result of the investment, then the secret is out. And, you know, essentially it becomes a scandal. If they are able to raise capital and recover from their financial troubles, then no one really knows to some extent that, you know, the announcement they made were false, unless somebody takes a closer look at the books. So again, you have to look beyond what's just been said in the news. You have to look a bit deeper into the company's financials, as well as look on the technical side as well. Like, how has this company performed in the past 5 years, you know, or the past 10 years, and what's going on in that particular sector? What's going on in that industry? Are they like likely to continue to grow and at what rate are they growing annually? You know, things like that would help you make a more informed decision. But as I mentioned in the first episode, these metrics and you know, understanding this kind of information and, you know, actually analyzing it is something that you don't necessarily have interest in, that's fine. There are investment managers that can sort of, you know, manage your investments for you. But it is good that when they are sort of, speaking to you about, oh, actually, we think we should rebalance your portfolio and sell the stock or buy the stock. And you sort of have some sort of understanding of how they are, able to give you that sort of advice. So I'm hoping that what I'm saying is making sense. But as I mentioned in last week's episode as well, if there are any questions about anything I've spoken about in any of the episodes, please feel free to DM Where Do I Begin Pod on Instagram, or feel free to email as well. And there'll be a Q&A episode at some point, and I can, you know, answer those in the episode, or I can just respond to them immediately, depending on the nature of the question. Another thing that can affect the price of the stock, we touched on this last week, is obviously the economy. Whenever, you know, we're experiencing economic growth, share prices tend to be quite high, which makes it difficult for some people to buy in, but it means that, you know, companies are doing well, and as a result you get higher returns. And the reverse is also true. So whenever the economy is going through a downturn, like we have been as a result of the pandemic, share prices tend to be lower. Now obviously things are beginning to pick up, so eventually the economy will bounce back. So you will notice that maybe probably towards the end of this year, you know, stock prices will begin to start rising, basically. So now is still definitely a good time, you know, to buy into the market, because you will be getting more for your money. Whereas very often when there's economic growth, it tends to come with inflation. And the problem with inflation is that you're getting less for your money. I'm going to touch on that a bit more in a bit. Another factor that could affect the stock price is the political climate. You know, whenever there's any sort of political tensions or instability, you know, it tends to make investors uncertain about, you know, investing in the stock market, because you have to remember that sometimes the stock market is a representation of how a country's economy is doing. You know, on the stock market, you have different companies from, you know, different countries around the world, and people all around the world investing in US stocks or UK stocks, or, you know, stocks in France or whatever industry, or Germany manufacturing. You know, they're quite known for manufacturing and cars and that sort of stuff. So if you think about, let's say, the UK, for example, when there was the whole issue of Brexit and things were still quite uncertain, you will notice that the value of the pound fell. The reason for that is because investors all over the world, not just within the UK, weren't sure what was going to happen, and they didn't feel as confident as they were about the UK economy. So most likely they either moved their investments elsewhere or sold their UK stocks to put it somewhere else that they felt it would be safe for that period of time. And then once things started to pick back up and the pound started to get stronger, they probably moved it back. If you think about, you know, the US, for example, with the Black Lives Matter movement and the tensions and things that have been going on over there, you know, that also affected US stocks. At some point, US stocks were falling, you know, but now things again are beginning to sort of, you know, pick back up a little bit. So those are definitely factors that will sort of influence the stock price. And some of these you wouldn't know exactly for sure, and that you wouldn't know exactly for sure that they were the reasons why the stock price were what they were at a particular day, at a particular time, until a few years down the line when you look back. Whereas some of it you can pretty much sort of, you know, speculate and sort of, I guess, come to a conclusion that, okay, it's because this was going on at this particular time, that's the reason why this particular company was you know, affected in this way, or this particular stock was affected in this way. And obviously you have analysts that really you know, break these things down and do financial modeling and, you know, sort of analyze the numbers. You know, they're not just going by what has been said or what's happening around them. They're actually looking at the numbers and studying those numbers and breaking those down to sort of verify whatever their assumptions are on why the stock price was what it was on a particular day, at a particular time. Okay, so now I'm going to, I guess, look at a brief case study. So let's look at Tesla, because I mentioned Tesla earlier on. So Tesla's stock price at the moment is currently about $611. And this is probably going to sound a bit like controversial. That's the word. Bear with me, I was trying to look for the word. Because throughout the whole of last year, I can't count how many times people were saying Tesla, 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 buying Tesla, buying the Tesla. And I was probably one of the very few people that was very much like, no thanks. And not because Tesla is not a great company. Tesla is a great company, but I'm an investor that thinks about, I sort of invest with a long-term view. So as a result, Tesla did not fit the profile of a company that I should put my money in if I'm thinking of, you know, long-term returns essentially. And the reason for that was due to quite a few things, which I'm going to go through, which I think people didn't sort of, well, some people either weren't aware or just sort of didn't think about when they were buying into the stock, because obviously the stock price for Tesla has been falling over the past few weeks. And now people are thinking, yeah, now might be the time to sell. Okay. So one of the reasons why Tesla was a no-go for me was because I looked at its PE ratio. So what's the PE ratio? PE ratio is also known as a price to earnings ratio or multiple. And it's the most commonly used metric to determine a company's value relative to its earnings. So price, stock price to its earnings. Now, the PE ratio of Tesla was or is currently 122. The industry PE ratio for, the industry that Tesla belongs to, which would be the, I think it's called automotive or automobile. Believe me, I'm not really a car person, is 16. Now, you can see that that is exponentially much higher than what the, what the industry is doing on average. So what the average, you know, electronic vehicle car company is earning in relation to what the stock price is saying. So for me, the numbers weren't aligning. Now, normally as a rule of thumb, they will tell you any company, regardless of the industry, that has a PE ratio greater than 10 is a high growth company, that it's that's promising and that's a good company to invest in. But when you're looking at the PE ratio, you can't just go with the rule of thumb of 10. You also have to look at the industry average. In this case, the industry average for Tesla is 16, but the PE ratio of Tesla was 122. So it's kind of like it's significantly, astronomically much higher than the industry average. Why is, like, if it was 32, for example, that would be double what the industry average is. You can sort of almost make sense of that and just be like, they're growing at twice the rate of what they're competitors are, let's say, or the average company in the industry, in the electronic vehicle industry, is growing at. Well, you can't even say that for Tesla. Now, mind you, just because the PE ratio is significantly higher than the industry average, again, doesn't mean it's not a good investment to have. It just means that most likely that stock is quite volatile, as we've seen over the past year. Like, if you go to study Tesla's stock price over the past, like, 5 years, you would be able to see on a chart how volatile, like, even look at what the stock price was in 2019. You would be amazed to see how volatile this stock is. Now, that's not to say that that can't change in the future where, you know, the company is growing at a steady rate. But for me, seeing that, I was like, yeah, that's not something I can live my money in. For the long term, Tesla is a stock that, you know, if I wanted to invest in Tesla, it's a stock that I would invest in for the short term. So maybe I'll hold it for 3 to 5 years, for example. And the minute the the price starts dropping, most likely I will sell it, or I may even choose to sell it when it's reached the highest possible price that, let's say, is reached in the, it's peaked, its price has peaked at the highest possible price that it's ever attained, let's say in the past, I don't know, 2 years, 3 years, maybe 4 years, and I'll just lock in on my profit and then reinvest that money into a different company. So that was definitely one of the deterrents for me as to why I didn't go for Tesla. And for the PE ratio, by the way, guys, you don't have even have to worry yourself about calculating it, even though it's very easy. What you can do is you can do this for any stock. You can literally just Google PE ratio of Tesla or PE ratio of Apple or whatever stock it is that you're interested in buying. Then also Google what industry that company belongs to, and then what the average PE ratio is in that industry, and then compare the two before you make a decision. So the PE ratio is basically one of the quickest ways to sort of value a stock and decide if it's worth investing in. Another reason why I didn't invest in Tesla, and I wasn't initially a Tesla fan, was because at the annual meeting in 2020 that took place on September 22nd at 1:30 p.m. to be exact, one of the things that was said was that they had a few priorities. So some of them were that they were looking to produce 20 million cars per year over the next 10 years. Stay with me, guys. They currently own the patents to the cheapest battery on Earth, which is positive. They're also looking to build factories at 70% less cost, all while selling software through these vehicles. Now, at the time when they announced this, analyst sentiments was that Tesla is overhyped, is overvalued, all which I agree on. But remember earlier when I said hindsight is 2020. At the time when they said this at their annual meeting, analysts were sort of forecasting that Tesla would be able to produce 2 million cars per year. Mind you, this meeting that I'm talking about took place September 22nd, 2020. We're in 2021, right? Okay, cool. Just stay with me. I'm going somewhere here. Now, they forecasted that Tesla would be able to produce 2 million cars in output per year, even though the stock price at the time implied that they would be able to produce more than 2 million. We should have suggested that they might be able to meet their aim of 20 million per year over the next 10 years. Guess what, guys? Before I started recording this episode, I actually went to find out how many cars the Tesla produced last year. They produced about 400,000, which was not even half of what analysts forecasted. And I sort of suspected this was going to happen. One, for many reasons, we're in a pandemic. But also, this has been a pattern with Tesla. And there's nothing wrong in being ambitious and doing forecasts. But when you're not even hitting the halfway mark, it's a bit worrying. So for me, it was unsettling for me again to say, okay, yes, I completely believe in everything that Tesla is doing and in everything that Tesla is saying. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying they deliberately misled people, but as I mentioned, it's a very high volatile stock, and this has been reflected even in their priorities and them not meeting the goals that they've sort of set as a result. So I didn't feel comfortable as an investor putting my money into Tesla. Now, that's not to say I wouldn't buy Tesla in the future. I probably would, but again, as it stands, based on what I know of the company so far, Tesla is a stock I would only ever hold for the short term, just because of how volatile it is. Another reason why I didn't I guess buy a Tesla stock was because of the pandemic, and I thought about it, and I had read somewhere as well that this is common sense in a way. Obviously, we're in a pandemic, or we still are. We're technically still in lockdown in the UK. So as a result, how many people were really buying Tesla cars in 2020? Let's think about it. We're all indoors. No one was going anywhere. Do you understand what I mean? So even in terms of their sales, and Tesla cars being a core service of theirs, if they were not making, the level of revenues that they were making before the pandemic, where was the rest of their money coming from? How is this company, still surviving? Now, I mentioned earlier in the announcement that they own the patents to the cheapest battery on Earth. They probably sell those batteries to other car companies. Again, do your own research, I haven't verified that part. They sell software as well. So again, I haven't verified that, but what they did say is that they are selling software through their vehicles. I don't know if they sell that, you know, separately. So they're probably making money from that as well. But what came to my attention and what I read was that a lot of the money in terms of revenues that Tesla actually made in 2020 came from the excess carbon permits that they did not use, that they sold to other companies that needed this permit. Okay, so carbon permits, as you know, many of you may or may not know, is basically, it's almost like an allowance that you get to leave a carbon, you know, footprint, essentially. Obviously, we're trying to, you know, be considerate of the planet and the world that we're living in so that we leave it better for the generations that are coming behind. And given that Tesla specializes in electronic vehicles, it means that their carbon footprint is much lower than a company that's still, you know, producing cars like the old-fashioned way. So as a result, every car company has an allowance, but Tesla is never going to use all the allowances because they've gone electric, so which means they use less carbon in the production of their cars and the car part. Okay, so as a result, they sell that to other companies that may need it, and that was where majority of their revenue came from. Now, that's not a negative thing, but it just, again, for me, it just wasn't adding up. Like, it just wasn't adding up as to why the stock price was not actually reflecting what the earnings were over the past year. And that's just, I guess, something else to sort of think about, because like I said, Tesla cars, I don't know, there wasn't a huge rush to buy Tesla cars in 2020, you know, to my knowledge. So it wasn't like there was a high demand, so why was the price high? You know, the revenues wasn't, you know, the levels that you would have expected if they were selling cars, which is due to the pandemic and probably other factors that I've not necessarily looked at. But why did the price continue to stay high? Do you guys get where I'm going with this? So that's what I'm saying, that that's why I'm saying, like I said in the previous episode, that you genuinely cannot make a decision based off of, yeah, the stock price was high today or it was low. You know, you would be misleading yourself and potentially you could lose a lot of money. Something that was actually said by a professor that I read recently, an economics professor, was that he believes that the current electronic vehicle market is suffering from market delusion. And he says that just because the future of transport is undoubtedly electric doesn't mean that companies selling electric cars make good investments. So that might be something to think about whenever you're thinking of, you know, making an investment decision, particularly in the electronic vehicle space. You know, it's something that you can potentially research as to, you know, aside from Tesla making cars and the cheapest batteries in the world and selling software, you know, what other investments does Tesla as a company hold? What other things are they investing in at the moment? And are those investments potentially profitable? Are they good investments? Good investments, would they help the future growth of the company? Those are, again, you know, things to think about. As we've all seen in recent weeks, Tesla's stock price has been falling. So most analysts would probably suggest now would be a good time to sell it, or you can just hold on to it till the price picks back up again, because that's what happens in the stock market. It goes up, comes down. What goes up must come down, as they say. So, and then see if it's able to recover, and if in a few years down the line the stock is not as volatile as it's been over the past 2-3 years essentially. Now, one of the stocks I guess I would sort of suggest you guys taking a look at, so when I mentioned market news earlier, this is the part that's important. Well, everything I've said is important, but this part is also important, is the car company Volkswagen. So they're currently expanding and they're looking to also make the transition into electric cars. Now, I know like last year, especially when the stock price of Tesla was continued to rise, a lot of people sort of felt a sense of regret that they didn't get in when it was quite affordable to buy the stock. So I'm bringing Volkswagen to your attention because they're looking to make that transition. So if you want to sort of invest in the electronic vehicles that they're going to be producing very soon, now might be a good time to sort of buy into Volkswagen before the price rises, and then it's too expensive to buy and then you miss out on that opportunity. But again, as I always say, please do your research before you make any investment decision. Another issue with just going off of, I guess, what the stock price is on that particular day, and not looking deeper into, factors that may have influenced that, or what's going on in the market, is also when you look at the case of GameStop, which I also mentioned in episode one. GameStop was already failing, and you had people on Reddit and on social media that were sort of being told, oh, you should buy the GameStop stock. Now, I can almost guarantee you that quite a significant number of people that bought GameStop probably had never heard of GameStop until the moment where, social media was pretty much in a frenzy. And it's very important not to let the fear of missing out, mislead you into buying an overpriced stock. Because GameStop was overpriced because the company was already failing. And, investors thought they needed to retaliate against hedge funds, since they were short selling. But what they didn't realize is that short selling is not illegal, but colluding to manipulate the stock market was, which is what they were doing. And it makes no sense to invest in a company that, you know nothing about, is already failing, prospects for recovery were looking very dim. Like, a lot of people literally didn't do research. They just heard buy GameStop and they went for it. And the demand essentially was so high, Robinhood had to shut down, amongst other investment platforms that made GameStop available. When the time came to cash out, a lot of people lost money because they just didn't have the liquidity for people to cash out. And liquidity risk is something that people didn't, think about. If anyone is unsure what I mean by liquidity risk, it basically means how quickly you can turn an asset into cash if you need, to sell it. the stock itself was highly illiquid because of everything that was going on. So that's just sort of something else, to keep in mind when it comes to the stock market, stock price, what stocks you should be holding for, a couple of weeks, a few years, 3 to 5 years, or 10 year plus or more. So now I'm going to talk about portfolio construction. There's an old rule of thumb that basically tells you to subtract your age from 100, and that's the percentage of your portfolio that you should keep in stocks. The rest of the percentage you essentially keep in bonds. Now, obviously, at the time when this rule was created, most people only really invested in stocks or bonds. Those were like the real main, popular asset classes to invest in at the time. So the way that would work is, if you are currently 30 years old, if you subtract that from 100, you're left with 70. So essentially 70% of your portfolio should be invested in stocks, and then the rest of the 30% should be in bonds. Now, obviously, we're living longer, so that may vary. So you might need to subtract that number from maybe 110 or 120, for example, to help you get a different percentage. Now, the reason why portfolio construction is important is so that you can reduce the risks associated with the investments that you make. As I mentioned in the first episode, there is no way of investing without an element of risk. Risk is something that comes with investing. However, the level of risk that you're willing to take depends obviously on the types of stocks that you choose. And it also depends on how diversified your portfolio is. So diversification, basically, one of the benefits of diversification is that it gives you exposure to different markets, different industries, but it also helps you to minimize the risks associated with the investments that you're making. So let me give you an example. If you put all your money into, let's say, tech stocks, for example, and the tech industry are currently going through a downturn, you stand to lose essentially, you know, all of your money. And if not, you lose quite a significant amount. So that's not wise. So when you're investing, you need to be thinking of, I'm creating a portfolio, which is basically a collection of, you know, investments that you have, which belong to different asset classes. So what you need to do is maybe invest in tech, then invest in healthcare, then invest in commodities, for example. So that if the tech industry is being affected, then you know your investment in commodities or let's say even real estate, for example, would protect the rest of the portfolio. So if you're losing money in tech, you won't be losing money in real estate at the same time. It's that's not possible because they're not in the same industry and they probably have low correlation. I hope that's making sense. Whereas if all your money was just, I don't know, in real estate and the housing market was going through a downturn, again, the same with tech, you stand to lose majority of, you know, the initial capital and the return that you invested, or all of it. So that's why it's important to diversify. So in terms of the main asset classes, you have stocks, bonds, and cash. Those are known as, you know, traditional asset classes. Stocks are also known as equities, by the way, and it basically just means a shareholder, you know, in the company. Bonds are basically like a loan made by an investor to a borrower, and usually the borrower in this case is a government. But there are also different types of bonds. So you have corporate bonds, so you know, companies that issue out bonds. You have municipal bonds, and an example of government bonds is if you look at the US bonds, you know, you have T-bills, treasury bonds, and then you have, you know, UK government bonds. They're also known as gilts, for example. So these are what bonds are. And then you also have cash. So if you have an ISA, that will come under the cash, I guess, investment or cash asset class. If you have an ISA account, it will come under that. And then you also have alternative investments. So alternative investments are basically financial assets or investments that do not fall into the traditional asset classes, which I mentioned earlier with stocks, bonds, and cash. So alternative investments would be things like private equity, venture capital, hedge funds, real estate, commodities, and so on and so forth. Even art, for example, you know, will come under alternative investment. You know, if the Mona Lisa in France at the Louvre was to ever be sold, that would belong into the alternative investment asset class. But when it comes to the, I guess, alternative investment asset classes, the one asset that I wanted to talk about is real estate investment trust. But just before I get to that, to just wrap up on the portfolio construction, when you're thinking of, I guess, purchasing stock, these are a few things to keep in mind in terms of diversifying your portfolio. So you need to potentially look at dividend paying stocks, like I mentioned earlier. So those are also known as income paying stocks because you get an income, you know, from them. And as I mentioned, the dividends could either be paid quarterly or annually. Then you need to look at investing in some growth stocks as well. So growth stocks would be things like, you know, Apple, Tesla, for example. Growth stocks don't pay dividends, so essentially you make your money when you sell the stock. And then you also need to invest in index funds. That's also known as passive investing, because essentially that's literally just tracking the market market for you. You don't have to worry about like managing it. And it's a group of stocks that have historically performed well and continue to perform well. So you need to have a bit of that in your portfolio. You need to potentially have ETFs, which are exchange traded funds. I spoke on them a little bit last week. You obviously need to have bonds. I mentioned bonds, but more specifically, you need to have inflation linked bonds. Now, remember earlier I was talking about inflation and how it essentially means that you're getting less for your money, and it could affect the returns on your investment. What inflation linked bonds does is it protects you as an investor from the impact of inflation. So when you think about it, let me give an example. If you have a portfolio, an equity portfolio with a return of 4% per year, and the current inflation rate was 2.5%, the actual real return, so the actual amount you're getting on your investment, would be 1.5%. How did I get from that number? You take the inflation rate away from what the actual return was that you would have been getting had there not been inflation. So 4 minus 2.5, that gives you 1.5%. Really and truly, instead of you making 4% a year on your investment, you're only making 1.5% a year. Whereas when you invest in inflation-linked bonds, you get that protection where you may not get the 4%, but you definitely get more than, you may not get So when you invest in inflation-linked bonds, instead of your returns going down, it still goes up because your returns or the stock or the asset itself would have taken into account the effects of basically inflation. So that way you're not losing money because it would have already taken that into consideration. So it basically gives you protection. I hope that makes sense. Okay, so now I'm going to talk about real estate investment trusts. And honestly, these are one of my favorite products. And I really wanted to touch on it on this episode because I was having a conversation earlier this week with a friend who was looking to, you know, get into the property ladder. And he was saying that, you know, obviously trying to put down a deposit can be quite hard and et cetera, et cetera. And I had this conversation with somebody else like 2 weeks ago who lives in a different country. They don't necessarily have the barrier of like putting down money for a deposit, but it was just the fact that it's just quite expensive to get into, you know, the real estate market because it's quite, you know, cost intensive. Now I'm apologizing because this episode is going to be slightly longer than even the first episode, which wasn't planned, but I did tell you guys from the beginning we had a lot to get to, and it's important I say this in this episode. So here we go. The thing with real estate investment trusts and why I love them is that it basically gives you a chance to own valuable real estate without the stress of having to actually manage the property or find a tenant or, you know, even invest in building the property from scratch and everything else that comes, you know, with owning a house. So what is a real estate investment trust? A real estate investment trust is a company that owns, operates, or finances income producing real estate. Okay. And they also, you know, pay dividends. So that's the good thing about them. And essentially, they give you an additional income, which is the goal when, you know, it comes to investing. The real estate investment trust, I guess, industry is actually a very, very big industry. In the US, I think at the moment they're worth $1 trillion or something like that. $1 trillion, you know, US dollars. So I'm not sure what the number is in the UK. And there are different property types that real estate investment trusts cover. So whereas instead of like, I guess, instead of buying, you know, multiple mortgages and then finding tenants or paying one mortgage off and then, you know, using it to buy another house and then renting that out and owning properties and investing in real estate in that manner, the real estate investment trust gives you the opportunity to just sit back on the other side and have other people do that work for you. Does that make sense? So they invest in a range of property types, and it's not just, you know, mortgages. So they invest in offices, for example, so office buildings, apartments, apartment buildings, warehouses, retail centres, and that's for both, I don't know, clothes shopping or, you know, like the grocery stores, for example. They invest in medical facilities, data centres, cell towers, infrastructure and hotels. And you don't literally have to worry yourself about, you know, the management of those buildings, the rent of those buildings. You just invest in the trust and there are people on the ground doing the work for you. And, you know, your money is just growing. Bear with me a moment. The other good thing about real estate, as I mentioned earlier, they pay out dividends. And there is also a stipulation that the investment trust must pay out at least 90% of their taxable income to shareholders. And usually they pay exactly that. So investing in a real estate investment trust is not an investment where you're not sure, you know, how much you're making or if or when the money is going to come in or how much is going to come in. Like, it's a very secure way of investing in real estate and be guaranteed essentially an income. Historically, they've delivered competitive total returns based on high steady dividend income and long-term capital appreciation. They also have comparatively low correlation with other assets. So other assets being, you know, stocks and bonds, for example, if you had those in your portfolio, which makes them an excellent portfolio diversifier that can help reduce the overall portfolio risk and increase your returns. So again, if you want to read up more on real estate investment trusts, please do. You can do your Googles. If you have more questions and, you know, I lost you somewhere in the explanation, please DM me. But I'm really trying to round up now, hence why I'm rushing through. So if you're looking to invest in real estate trusts, as opposed to waiting until you have hundreds of thousands to buy a house and say I own two properties and rent it and all that good stuff. If you're interested in investing in real estate investment trusts, I have a few that I've, you know, researched, that I've looked into that may be of interest to you. Again, this is not investment advice, so do your own research to make sure that these are companies you want to invest in. But some of the I guess good ones to have a look at is Realty Income. So you can find that on the New York Stock Exchange, as well as Simon Property Group. In the UK, you can have a look at Vanguard Real Estate Exchange Traded Fund. You will find it as an ETF. I think the share price for that is currently $91. And the dividend yield is 3.65%. Again, you need to check if that would be paid annually or quarterly, but most likely I'm sure it will be paid annually. Another one you can look into is iShares US Real Estate ETF. The price for that is a bit more expensive. Oh, actually, no, it's around the same, just a little bit lower. So it's about $90.72. The dividend yield on that is 2.44%. Another one in the UK you can look into is Invesco S&P 500 Real Estate ETF. The cost for that is much lower as well. It's about $32.39. And the dividend yield for that is 3.45%. Depending on the investment platform that you're using, obviously the share price might either be in dollars or pounds. And some of the investment platforms may not have the real estate investment trusts that I've just mentioned, but some will allow you to request it, and others you just have to, I guess, purchase them on a different platform. Again, if you have any more questions on those, please do reach out to me. And that brings us to the end of today's episode. Thank you so much for listening. I know I've been talking for a while. Please share, follow, comment, subscribe, all that good stuff, and feel free to send a DM on Instagram at where_do_i_beginpod, or you can drop me an email at info.wheredoibeginpod@gmail.com. Again, thanks for joining me. That's all for today/this week's episode, and we'll talk again soon on the next episode. Take care.